It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The Monongahela, the Iroquois, the Algonquin, the Seneca, the Lenape or Delaware, some of the Native American peoples who have lived in what is now southwestern Pennsylvania. The names might be familiar, but how much more do we really know about these Native peoples? The Westmoreland Museum of American Art this weekend opened a new exhibition that explores Native American culture and the effects of colonialism. Ann Crabo is the director and CEO of the Westmoreland. Welcome to the Confluence.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I said exhibition, we might think of visual arts, but this is so much more. There's so much more programming built around this exhibition, isn't there?
Yes. So we have two exhibitions that explore this topic. And within that, we have a full roster of programs for a variety of different audiences to engage with these topics.
And it's about 3 months long, the whole thing?
Yes. So it just opened on Saturday to the public, and it runs for 3 months through June 30th.
Some of these other things, and we hope to get to them, performances, discussions, even culinary adventures?
Yes. So we are really excited to actually explore what happened with colonialism through food. So we have James Beard Award winning, we just found that out last week, Chef Sean Sherman. He's going to be coming, and we've partnered with the August Wilson Center to host a talk. And then at the Westmoreland Museum of American Art, he'll actually host a dinner. He will locally source indigenous ingredients. He will go out and forage for ingredients.
Forage?
Yes. So you could get some, you know, milkweed soup. You know, you could get some really amazing ingredients. But he's very interested in how, you know, refined sugars, refined flours and things like that really affected Native American diet and health. And so he's really hoping to reclaim those ingredients so that it's part of his culture, too.
We learn a lot about culture through food, no matter what culture it is, don't we?
Absolutely. Food is culture.
All right. The anchor of this program, the anchor of this that extends through June 30th, is an exhibition called Mingled Visions, the photographs of Edward S. Curtis and Will Wilson. Edward Curtis did his work in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. How extensive was his work? Give us an idea.
So Curtis was, you know, a pioneer for his time. Think about, you know, when photography came on the scene, it was new technology. It was not very portable. He devised a portable studio, and he went out, you know, for decades and documented Native Americans west of the Mississippi. And the reason is because most of them had been forcibly relocated to reservation systems, right? So he's really concerned about the potential cultural loss, even dubbing one of his photographs, quote unquote, the vanishing race. Hmm. You think about that today, it's really problematic. And, you know, he came out of a place of genuine concern, but some of his photographs were contrived or staged to present Native Americans as he wanted them to be seen. And some he didn't even photograph, for instance, the Osage at the time, were some of the wealthiest people of the nation because of the oils that they had discovered in Oklahoma. And he sort of left that whole history out of his portfolios. So when I first came to the museum and I heard that we had this exhibition on the schedule, I was excited, but I was also concerned, and I realized we needed to have a counterpoint and another voice in that exhibition. And so we invited Will Wilson, who's a Navajo Nation tribal member, mm-hmm. photographer. He runs the photographic program at Santa Fe Community College. He's been in museums throughout the country, throughout the world, and created the Critical Indigenous Photographic Exchange, where he has documented, using that same technology that Curtis used, documented Native American artists, scholars, people. But he sort of says, everything's been indigenized because I'm the artist making the work. And so, you know, he has these beautiful tintypes that he then digitizes and blows up. And so those are on view next to Curtis's photography.
All right. So again, to Curtis, I mean, the work was extensive in sheer volume of work, wasn't it?
Yes. I mean, volumes and volumes. And he really looked at this as a business venture, thinking that he could get people to invest in this project. It never took off. Unfortunately, he really died penniless. And it wasn't until the 1970s when it was rediscovered that this really had incredible value.
So the whether it had a staged effect or from a certain point of view from Curtis, is this the biggest collection of images we have from Native American people, or I should say of Native American people?
Certainly. And it wasn't just images. It was sound recordings. He actually did some film as well. Mm-hmm. So a huge, extensive archive. And for many people, you know, and Will says, too, that he's so glad these things are here because it's a testament to these people. It's a testament to surviving what he equates to basically genocide.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit more about Will Wilson's work. The mingling in the title, Mingling Visions, is that where the two come together, Curtis's vision and Will Wilson's vision?
It is, but ironically, it was actually the title that the Curtis exhibition came with. And we were thinking about changing it. And then when we introduced Will into the project, we thought, this title actually works. So, it is these sort of mingled visions in conversation with each other.
How did Will Wilson... Contemporary, you mentioned the technology, but things have changed over the decades. How did he try to show the changes, but also say, here's a different eye looking at what Curtis had looked at decades earlier?
Well, the first thing he did was he did not stage his sitters. He does not stage his sitters. The sitters present themselves exactly as they want to be. We have sitters that, you know, that he invites to wear whatever outfits, whatever they want, whatever expression they carry. And so you'll see a huge variety of how people present themselves. He also uses a wet plate technology, which is a little bit different than Curtis. And so you'll see much more sort of, you know, accidents that happen in the chemical reactions mm-hmm. in the process. But then what he does is he takes this incredible 21st century technique of augmented reality. And he films people while he's photographing them. And so when you come to the exhibition, you can hold up an iPad to some of the images and the people will start talking to you. Hmm. So he's sort of like Curtis is taking the technology of his day and introducing it into these photographs.
And Curtis, as you mentioned, also did the audio recordings as well.
Yeah.
So very interesting. And something I read about this is that was Will trying to show that these peoples haven't just stopped in a point of time, that they continue to grow like we all do?
Absolutely. So I think part of what he was reacting to was that title, Vanishing Race. And he's like, well, hey, wait a second. We're not a static culture. You know, we've been part of American society over the past century. And so he's definitely reacting to that. And he's also taking an opportunity to introduce Curtis in a different way through a different lens for a new audience.
You also have another exhibition as part of this. It's called The Outsider's Gaze, exploring the role of 19th and early 20th century European American artists in creating and reinforcing stereotypes of Native Americans. By exploring the role of these artists who created, perpetuated the stereotypes, is that sort of perpetuating the stereotypes themselves, or do you have to sort of publicly acknowledge, here is how some artists presented Native peoples, and now we can move on to the reality?
Yeah, so when you see the exhibition, you'll see a variety of ways in which artists were presenting at representations of Native Americans. Many artists were genuinely concerned that there was going to be a loss of culture. Many artists lived alongside tribes and, you know, did fairly accurate representations. Many artists romanticized Native Americans mm-hmm. because of this concern. So some of the images look rather poetic. Other artists depicted Native Americans as, you know, the quote-unquote noble savage. And, you know, many of these artists were traveling with U.S.-led expeditions and sending these works back east. And so for us, it wasn't necessarily perpetuating, but just acknowledging that these artworks were a product of their time, but they live with us today. And so we need to look at them through a different lens.
Speaking of acknowledging, as part of the programming, the museum is acknowledging the peoples who were on the land first.
Yes, so this was fascinating for me, being a newcomer to the area. I have an incredible team, and one of our members took it upon himself to research the history of Native American culture, which is not that well documented or taught, unless you're simply talking about the French-American War, mm-hmm. those types of events. And so from that, we were able to create a land statement of the Native peoples that would have resided on this land pre-European contact, through European contact.
And this land statement, how are you sort of presenting it? Well, I mean, what are you doing with
it? So it is in text in the exhibition, and we do plan to have some sort of more permanent acknowledgement on our facility. But we're also introducing it in our remarks before we gather. So with our exhibition opening for members on Friday night, the first thing I said was the land statement.
It's Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Ann Krehbill, the director and CEO of the Westmoreland Museum of American Art. When you took over leadership of the 60-year-old organization last August, what were your short and long-term goals?
Well, the first thing, you know, it's an incredible facility. My predecessor, Judy O'Toole, did an amazing job building this state-of-the-art museum. And I just felt like there are not enough people that even know we are here and taking advantage of all that we have to offer. So my most immediate goal is getting more people into the door and getting them to engage with us, not only just through the exhibitions, but through all of our programs. Long term, I'm really looking at, we're a museum of American art. We have an opportunity and a responsibility to really diversify the conversation and expand the narrative to include many stories about what it means to be an American.
Mm-hmm. How important is the interactive component in making educational programming educational, of course, but also fun, engaging?
It's really important. So, you know, people want to feel like when they come to a museum and that they're having fun and they're connecting with their friends and with their family. And just the very definition of culture is changing. And so we're introducing, as I mentioned, the cultural or the culinary program.
Right.
But we've also invited a sketch comedy group called the 1491s to come to our Art on Tap. And so they're really, you know, kind of cynical and flip, but they talk about issues using comedy, which is a really great way for people to engage with these topics.
You were talking about your goals, short-term, long-term. How do they fit into the museum's mission itself?
So the mission has actually changed. As a staff, we got together, and the staff looked at when they were most proud to be a part of the organization. And from that, we created a mission statement that really talks about expanding perspectives and, you know, providing people with opportunities to engage with cultural experiences broadly. So it's not just about visual fine arts. And, you know, I think everything that we do maps back to that. So we now have a 3-year plan on how we can create programs, exhibitions, and engage not just on our facility, on our building site, but with the community, because we do realize that some of the barriers to coming to a museum is that they're perceived as elitist institutions.
You can have wonderful exhibitions, informative programming, interactive programming, but can't that all be for naught if accessibility is an issue, whether it's, you know, the hours of operation, being able to get there when the museum is open, and even the cost?
Yes. So we've addressed both of those issues. We decided to eliminate our suggested donation policy, and that was previously $15, which can be a very real barrier for mm-hmm. people. And we realized that if people are true supporters, that they will still give, but it will be on their own terms. We did have, like many other museums, free days, community right. days, but I really believe that access should be on your own terms. You should be able to come and go to the museum when it's open, when you want to. We also did realize that our hours might not be that convenient for people. So we've changed them so that we are open Wednesday, Thursday, Friday from 11 to 7. So those folks who maybe want to engage after work with their families can come. And then Saturdays and Sundays from 10 to 5.
And Monday and Tuesday, that's for school groups?
Monday and Tuesday, we're closed to the public. But yes, we'll have many partner programs happening, school groups, community groups. We're hoping to partner with some senior centers soon as well.
We have just about 90 seconds left. Is the challenge of any arts culture organization capture the interest of young people, potentially your prime supporters, patrons of the future? And how are you going to do that?
I think we have to be relevant, right? So we have to look at all of the amenities that we're offering. So we did actually just open a new cafe, Cafe Marchand, which features really fine food from the French Express, beers, wines. We have to have relevant programming. We have to have diverse exhibitions. We have to be welcoming, and we have to not only open our doors, but we have to extend an invitation.
Earlier, we were talking about the major spring program that's just opened up over the weekend, looking at Native American culture. What other programs do you have in mind for the future?
Well, we have an incredible exhibition of museum-quality driftwood coming up, April Fool's.
I was waiting for that. You almost had me, and my eyes were saying, huh?
We've got a great exhibition this summer of John Van Hammersfeld, who did the posters and many of the album covers for bands like Hendrix, Blondie, the Rolling Stones. It's going to be a great exhibition full of music, full of fun.
So it's full of music and anything else, even at least tease us a little bit.
Well, in the fall, we're going to be partnering with the Associated Artists of Pittsburgh, and they'll be having their annual exhibition. And then, you know, well, 2020, we've got a lot of surprises, but you'll have to stay tuned.
All right. Ann Craybill is the director and CEO of the Westmoreland Museum of American Art. Ann, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. Residents in the airport area and South Hills vote in a special election tomorrow to select a state senator in the 37th district. Could this race serve as a preview for the 2020 election cycle? The partial reactor meltdown at Three Mile Island was partly responsible for moving public opinion away from nuclear energy. A more recent and more devastating nuclear accident in Japan had a similar effect on the public's views. And the Allegheny County Health Department is expected to conduct annual inspections of food establishments, but it's falling behind due to a lack of inspectors. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Somerset County announces the construction of the state's first wind farm in 2000. The Green Mountain Wind Energy Center operated 8 turbines and could produce about 27,000 megawatt hours of electricity each year. That's enough to power more than 3,000 homes. It was deactivated in 2015, but Somerset County remains the home of 8 total wind farms with 198 turbines, the most of any other county in Pennsylvania. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. For more than a decade, the Hill Dance Academy Theater has been teaching the art of black dance. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook reports, in doing so, the dance company has lent itself to preserving and perpetuating the Hill District's rich cultural heritage.
A number of well-known cultural icons have emerged from the Hill District. August Wilson, George Benson, and Mary Lou Williams, to name a few. But when it comes to the art of dance in recent years, one company comes to mind.
Hill Dance Academy Theater, we call it HDAT. Our mission is to train the next generation of dancers and to sustain black dance.
Aisha Morgan Lee is the company's CEO and artistic director. She founded the Hill Dance Academy Theater in 2004 at a time when she says there were too few people of color in dance performances and a lack of education regarding black dance.
When I grew up in the dance world, I was one of maybe 3 black students in the studio, and I just thought that Pittsburgh had so much more to offer. And that I wanted students to be able to come to a place where they could learn to dance, and they could see other students who look like them, and they could see teaching artists that look like them.
Students can start classes as early as 3 years old at HDAT, learning everything from ballet to a range of diverse dances, many becoming polished concert performers. However, Morgan Lee says dance is only one aspect of the company's curriculum.
We also teach them, you know, nutrition classes, acting classes, administration classes, the behind the scenes, the light, the set, the sound.
She says teaching children to be well-rounded professionals is a key to growth for the arts community across the board.
I am somebody.
In all honesty, I'd love for every single one of these 75 students to be a dancer, but that's not going to happen. But they learn about their history, they learn about dance, they then become your funders, they then become your audience, they then become your supporters, your board members, they then become the people who are running the dance organizations, running the companies, so there's so much more opportunities for them.
Good evening, ladies, how are we?
Good.
Excellent, excellent. We are going to start by warming up.
My daughter just turned 18, so she's been coming about 10 years now.
Deborah Bennett says she's pleased with her daughter Mia's growth and maturation as a performer.
There's something here that is being nurtured in our girls and some of our young men as well that they're not getting anywhere else.
Daylin Moore echoes what Bennett says. An eighth grade student at Gateway Middle School, Moore says she has benefited tremendously from the programming.
Hadat has helped me both dance-wise and mentally and physically, being healthy. They make sure that they pull that out of us. Dance actually gives me more discipline, whether it's inside of school or outside of school at home. They actually do make sure that I stay on top of my game, stay on top of my grades.
Although the Hill Dance Academy Theater accepts 75 students per session, Aisha Morgan Lee says thousands have come through the company over the past 15 years.
It's very significant for me for us to be in the Hill, because why not the Hill? Why can't the Hill have a place that sees art thriving and has a strong, successful dance academy? And know who we are, so we are not Pittsburgh's best kept secret anymore. And not just known nationally, but known here in Pittsburgh as a gem.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Residents in the Airport area and South Hills vote in a special election tomorrow, choosing a state senator in the 37th district. 90.5 WESA's Chris Potter reports the race could preview the 2020 election.
Both sides have predicted a tight race, which pollster Chris Borick says will be closely watched.
People are looking to get some hints about where the mood of the electorate is.
The Democrat, Pam Iovino, is a former naval officer. She's raised over $1 million from inside and outside the district. Laura Putnam is a University of Pittsburgh professor who studies suburban politics. She says that Iovino can draw on grassroots energy that helped Connor Lamb win a congressional seat last year.
The grassroots stalwarts are 100% all in on this race, and they have been since even before Pam Iovino was chosen as candidate.
Republican Dee Raja, who runs a successful software consulting firm, has strengths of his own. One is deep pockets. As of Friday, he'd invested $1.2 million of his own money in the race. The campaign has been fought along familiar lines. Iovino favors attacks on natural gas drilling, for example, which Raja opposes. He's also blasted Iovino with ads on controversial abortion laws in other states. Iovino hasn't backed those laws, and observers say that Republicans overstate their impact. But Putnam and Borick say Tuesday's race could preview how campaigns will use abortion next year. Chris Potter, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week marked 40 years since the Three Mile Island nuclear accident in central Pennsylvania. The partial meltdown did not lead to large releases of radiation, but it helped turn public opinion away from nuclear energy. In Japan, a far more devastating nuclear disaster occurred 8 years ago last month. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips traveled to the site of that accident on Japan's East Coast and learned how that incident had a similar impact.
Everyone in Japan knows where they were on March 11th, 2011.
We had nothing in our hands. We just ran away.
Hiroshi Miura was working. He's a rice farmer who lived and farmed along the Pacific coast in Fukushima Prefecture. In March 2011, the world's fourth largest earthquake ever measured struck here. It was quickly followed by a devastating tsunami. More than 16,000 people died.
The people who ran to the top of that hill, where there's a shrine, they survived. But the people in the cars, they died.
Miura and his family survived, but he says 68 of his neighbors washed away. The giant waves led to a meltdown at the nearby Daiichi nuclear power plant. Miura was one of about 154,000 people who fled the radioactive fallout. Like a lot of people in Japan today, Miura opposes all nuclear energy.
The age of nuclear power is over.
Today, Miura's fields are covered with solar panels. Like a lot of farmers near the plant, he can make more money using his land as a solar field than growing rice. Nearby, workers are building a seawall to protect the area from future tsunamis. They are also removing contaminated soil, bagging it in white plastic, and stacking it in fields along the nearby highway, where it will remain for decades.
This is a crazy road.
Driving through the mountains with my translator, Hiro Sasso, we're further inland, and there are still signs telling us not to linger. The area contains high levels of radiation. We pass abandoned homes nestled in red cedar forests. Toys lie scattered among high weeds. Metal gates with warning signs block access to driveways or smaller roads. Digital billboards display how much radiation we're being exposed to. Yuji Onuma and his wife and two sons now live away from the coast on the other side of the mountains. Onuma used to live in Futaba, about 3 or 4 kilometers from the Daiichi nuclear power plant. But right now, he's in a town that is as far away from any of Japan's 54 nuclear power plants as he can possibly be. Onuma shows me a picture of when he was about 12 years old, getting an award from the town mayor. His teacher had asked the kids to come up with a town slogan. In a place where everyone depended on the nearby nuclear plant for work, Onuma's entry won. Atomic power, energy for a bright future, became the slogan on an archway over the town's main street.
I was very proud because this was my first ever award by the town. And all the townspeople told me, you are very great, so I was so proud of that.
Then Onuma shows me another photo. It's a few months after the accident, and no one is left living in the town. This time, he's wearing a protective Tyvek suit and mask. He's standing below the sign, holding up a placard that changes his slogan to Atomic Power, Energy for a Destructive Future.
I made the wrong slogan, but I'm glad that I realized it's wrong before I died.
Although Onuma has regrets about the slogan he created, he fought with town officials about taking down the sign.
I said keep the sign as it is, as a kind of teaching tool. It should remain as part of the bitter memory of the town.
The sign came down, and today, Onuma is committed to renewable energy. He has a new business promoting solar panels, which he has installed on his own house. He wants his young sons, born after the accident, to live in a nuclear-free world.
I'm preparing my children's future, one in which they don't have to rely on nuclear power.
Immediately after the accident, Japan shut down all of its nuclear plants, which had provided 30% of the nation's energy. Natural gas imports increased. Although nuclear power remains unpopular among the Japanese people, the government supports atomic energy. It says it needs nuclear if it's going to cut carbon emissions. Now, reactors at 5 plants have gone back online. But Onuma says he won't stop pushing for renewable energy.
I feel that I'm a living witness to what went wrong. So I myself become the banners and the signs to show that. I am the witness.
The last photo he shows me has him again in a protective Tyvek suit. He stands at the town's main street, where the steel archway that bore his slogan, Atomic Power, Bright Energy Future, is now gone. This time, he holds a placard with a question mark and says, "The past cannot be erased." Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Reporting for the story was made possible with a grant from the International Center for Journalists. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Whether it's your favorite fancy restaurant or a diner or the neighborhood deli or the school cafeteria or even the volunteer fire department or church holding Lenten fish fries, they are all checked for food safety by Allegheny County Health Department inspectors. But right now, they're falling a bit behind due to a shortage of inspectors. Joining us now to talk about the shortage and if it's impacting food safety is the County Health Department's Deputy Director, Jim Kelly. Hello, Jim.
Good morning.
Jim, before we get to the shortage of the number of inspectors, the examples that I gave, they're just a few of the wide-ranging facilities that serve food. What other types we might not think about that the department actually inspects?
Well, you know, typically restaurants and various types of restaurants, but we also inspect food trucks. Any place that has any type of prepackaged food, say, we even inspect grocery stores and convenience stores, as well as, you said, the fish fries. So we have these seasonal events that we have to inspect as well. But then consider how many events you have in the summertime. You have a lot of festivals and fairs, and you know, there's a lot of food establishments that get temporary permits, and they have to be inspected as well.
So you have the year-round, and that's added upon with the seasonal events that feature food as well, correct?
Yes, yes.
And since the Penguins are in the playoff hunt and it's the home opener for the Pirates, does that include the ballpark and the arena as well?
Yes, they are inspected as well.
So what's the approximate number of facilities that you do inspect over the course of a year?
We have about 8,500 facilities that we have to inspect.
And when you're fully staffed with inspectors, how many do you have?
Right now we have 20 positions for inspectors, and that's including the fact that we actually increased our number of inspectors by one. So in 2018 we had 19. This year we've been given an extra position due to the, obviously, you know, it's an onerous job. There's so many facilities where you get a lot more complaints now, so you have to respond to those, as well as the fact that we, in the last couple of years, we've had a lot of openings. And so we have added to our staff, so we have an additional person to kind of help deal with those times when we're down two or three inspectors, sometimes more.
So what kind of effort is there to fill the open positions and that additional spot that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, one of the things we're trying to do is, you know, advertise the position more, to look at the type of people who may be interested in it as well. Obviously, the pay for the position is not very impressive. However, a lot of people would get it right out of college that have to have some types of it's got to be a hard science degree typically for that. And so, you know, trying to find those students who are coming out, the people who like this job. I mean, it's you're in the field a lot. People really like that, interacting with the public as well as restaurants. You learn a lot about the industry. And so we're trying to find ways to, you know, target those types of people, because typically, you know, we just post on our website. And so we're not actively going out trying to recruit people. And so we're trying to change that approach now.
Mm-hmm. Are these typically like public health majors or what, newly out of college?
Well, they're typically, you know, again, the requirement is a 4-year degree with a science background, and say biology, environmental science, you know, any hard science, chemistry, because, you know, the requirements for the job, it's a lot of training. You have to understand, you know, the microbiology involved with foodborne illness.
Right. We hear about annual inspections. Clarify for us, is that a goal? Is it mandated? If it's mandated, by whom? The county, state?
So we actually follow federal rules.
Okay.
And so there are requirements to inspect, you know, a certain frequency. And, you know, in addition to that, when we have high priority issues, we have facilities that may have had a compliance issue in the past or continuing compliance issues, they'll actually inspect those about once every 6 months.
Okay. But I understand that there are many food establishments that have not been inspected since 2017. If that's the case, can you give us an idea of why so?
Well, obviously, we've had a lot of turnover, and in some of those areas, you know, the people were gone. There are different reasons for the turnover as well. But keeping up with that, you know, the supervisors have to schedule in according to their priorities. And so, say a facility has not been inspected for a while, well, they probably don't have much of a compliance issue. And so, in that area where the inspectors or moving inspectors into those areas, you know, they have to focus on those areas of concern. And so, you know, we make our priorities are the schools, complaints. We always have to respond to the complaints. Our complaints are always increasing year after year. We get more and more complaints. So we have to respond to that because that public input is really important for what our food safety program does as well.
So those priorities, are those the priorities for addressing the backlog? Are those your priorities in general?
Well, I mean, there's different priorities, obviously, but, you know, as far as addressing the backlog, you know, that's a long-term planning issue because, you know, you have to look at the number of inspectors you have and what you're going to do over the course of the year. But right now, I mean, your first priority is going to be schools, high-priority areas, and your complaints. And then from that, then you can look at to how you're getting back to your backlog. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And so when you're fully staffed, 20 inspectors plus the new position to handle the 8,500 food establishments that you mentioned. Are you stretched too thin? That's more than 400 per inspector per year.
It is, but you know they're pretty efficient. You know, and again, fully staffed at 20, that's going to be a new thing for 2019 because again, in the past, fully staffed would have been 19. But the interesting thing about food inspection, I mean, this job is ever evolving. You know, they have a lot of new challenges that they're having to deal with, like food trucks here in Pittsburgh. You know, a lot of people start these businesses and they don't understand. They need an inspection. They need to follow, you know, we need to inspect their, they need a permit and an inspection because we need to inspect our trucks. And so we need to find those trucks, the owners, work with them because compliance enforcement is what we try to do a lot of. And the other interesting thing, obviously, you're very aware, Pittsburgh is definitely a foodie city, so we have a lot of new facilities. But the interesting thing is, even though we have a lot of these new facilities, the total number of restaurants in the area hasn't increased that much because anytime you have a new one open, there's usually one that's closing. And one of the challenges with this is we're getting a lot of new people in the restaurant business that doesn't understand before you build, you have to submit a plan. And then, you know, their plan has to be approved to have the appropriate kitchen. We have to have the inspections. And a lot of these facilities are not doing that. And so we have to spend a lot more time working with these facilities to, you know, finding them, working with them. And that really slows us down as well.
Jim, we have less than a minute left.
Yes. Okay.
Are you hearing anything from restaurants and others? Are they concerned that they aren't getting inspected and that might, you know, sort of affect their business?
Well, I personally can't tell you that. I can follow up with our food safety manager and see if that is. But, you know, if there is a concern. But we do have a food advisory committee, and we work with them. And they are representatives from the food industry, the restaurant industry. And, you know, we meet with them quarterly. And, you know, they provide us some impact. And, you know, a lot of their concerns are that they really want us to be able to do our job because it makes them look better. And overall, you know, they're happy with what we do. And they are concerned that, you know, at times if we don't have enough people because it allows some of the restaurants that aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, they can get through. And then we start having more complaints. And as a total, you know, the food industry, you know, they don't want that to happen.
All right,
you know, Jim. They want to show that they're safe.
Jim Kelly is the Allegheny County Health Department's Deputy Director. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, 90 neighborhoods, one city. How do you make sure neighborhoods and their residents do not get left behind when it comes to moving forward through equitable development? We'll visit with Pittsburgh's Deputy Chief of Neighborhood Empowerment, Majestic Lane. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.